Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to a Mouse Clubhouse Conversation.
Hi, this is Scott Wolf, and this conversation is with Randy Thornton. Randy began his Disney career in 1987 as a clerk in Walt Disney Records, as it was called back then, and he soon became a producer involved in Disney's earliest CDs. But more importantly, Randy is responsible for preserving many of the classic Disney soundtracks. So many of the original soundtrack elements had deteriorated greatly. Some were even believed lost, and some had been destroyed simply because the company didn't realize how important they would be in the future. Without Randy's efforts, some of the historic soundtracks may have been lost forever. Even the soundtracks that had been released on record albums were inferior quality for an upcoming digital age, and those were limited to about 30 minutes. Some of the record soundtracks were re-recorded so they were not even the actual film soundtrack. I first met Randy in 1990 when we were working in the same building and on the same floor. I was telling someone of my love of Disney music, and they said, "You've got to meet Randy Thornton." I spent so many days just sitting in his office and listening to the crystal clear sounds of Disney music. They were sounding better than they did when the films were first released. And I know my boss was often frantically looking for me while I was in there, for which I feel bad. Well, a little. I'm so grateful for everything Randy did for me personally. When he was working on the Annette Funicello CD set with the legendary Tutti Camerata, who produced many of Annette's early recordings, Randy invited me to attend a mixing session, and I'm so glad I had my camera, as always. I also had camera in hand when Randy invited me to a session he was working on with the Sherman Brothers when he was producing a CD set of their music. One day, Randy and I were talking, and I was telling him about one of my favorite attractions which had been at Disneyland. It was called America Sings, and I loved the old record album, which included the attraction's original concept sketches by the show's designer, Mark Davis. I wore that album out as a kid, as well as the accompanying booklet. One day, I went to lunch, and when I came back, on my chair was that long-out-of-print America Sings album. Brand new, never listened to, complete with booklet. Randy found an extra one in the Disney Records archives, and he gave it to me. He was responsible for so many of my favorite memories while working at Disney. When I asked him about his favorite Disney memories, it turned out I was part of one of them. A memorable day at the Garden Terrace, which was a nice sit-down restaurant in the Disney studios. It was adjacent to the studio commissary. The Sherman Brothers wrote the songs for the film Summer Magic, and Randy had just discovered a certain song from that film. Actually, it's better if you hear Randy tell the story. Listen to this.
We were working on the Sherman Brothers album. It was you and Robbie and Bob and Michael Leon and I at the Garden Terrace.
Right.
And we started talking about it, and it was just after I had discovered on the front porch.
Yeah, Bob's favorite song.
And Bob goes, that's exactly right. And he goes, "Well, that's my favorite song." And he starts singing. "All I wanna do." Then you start singing, and I start singing, and Robbie starts singing, and Michael starts singing, yeah. And I am singing on the front porch in the Garden Terrace in the Disney commissary with Bob Sherman.
What great times those were. To begin this conversation from 2007, I asked Randy about his start with Disney. Here's Randy Thornton.
I got a job at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, running their multimedia auditorium and also handing out photo and film equipment. And I met a lot of the film students and photography students, and ended up writing a couple of student film scores.
Really?
Just little simple little things. And decided I wanted to become a film score composer. But I just didn't really have the training or the background. I mean, I feel pretty lucky that I can pick up a lot of things, and I think of things musically, but I could never really consider myself a real musician. So I was really kind of floundering around, and one of the, I'd always had an affection for Disney, I wanted to be an animator, but that dream kind of went away after a while, and one of the film students got a job as an apprentice editor at the studio, and I said, God, it'd be great to, work at the studio, I mean, to get involved in the industry somehow, I don't care, mailroom, yeah, the Disney studio. I said, if there's ever an opening in the mailroom, let me know. And about a year or two went by, and he called me up, and he goes, "Yeah, there's a position in the mailroom." In the old days, they used to post those things, because there were no computers and all that stuff, so there were actual physical pieces of paper posted on bulletin boards in the hallways. And And I applied. I was at Art Center. I'd been there for about 3 years at that point. And I got a very nice letter back saying that there wasn't a position of mutual interest, and that they will keep my resume on file. And I'm going, oh, well. It was a shock.
I got one of those letters, too.
Yeah.
Actually, I got it after I got a job, believe it or not.
Well, about 2 weeks later, I get a phone
really?
Call asking me to come in for an interview. And so I was just stoked. I go, well, we was wondering if we can schedule an interview with you. I'll be there tomorrow. Yeah. I could be there now. I would have been there yesterday. So I don't really have any high aspirations, you know. So I just figured it'd be just a really cool way to earn a paycheck. And I go in for the interview, and I do my little typing test, and they go, well, we're going to call you back for a second interview. But just a second, let me see if Ron is available. He goes, well, first let me tell you what this is for. This is for the clerk in the music company. And at that point, the little guys in my head are going, my guy!
Yeah.
And it's the clerk for the music department. And what that is, you'll be running around doing errands. There is a company car, but, you know, if it's booked, would you mind using your own car kind of thing? And I go, no, yeah, whatever it takes. And he was sort of outlined kind of what it was, but not really. And he leaves the room to make the call to Ron. And I'm sort of, ah, ha, ha! And he goes, yeah, Ron's available right now. So I'm really jazzed. And I'm thinking, you know, it doesn't matter from this point on. It doesn't matter whether I get the job or anything. Right. I am going for a second interview in the same day, and I'm walking down Mickey Avenue at the Disney Studio, heading for the ROD building.
That's such a great feeling, isn't
and
it?
You just need to go, I'm smiling, and I'm not very much of a smiler. And I had my sunglasses on and everything, and this was 1987. And I go up and have the interview, and I'm not a very outgoing kind of guy, and large crowds of people actually frighten me to a degree. And so, but none of that was bothering me. And I sat down waiting for Ron, and there was one of the secretaries was there, and I actually struck up a conversation. Another thing I normally don't do.
Yeah.
And was called in for the interview, and everything went fine, and I left. And it turns out, I was told later, that when a job posting, particularly then, it was opened up to the staff first, so people that were already on staff could apply for that job. And several people had applied for it, and were coming up and asking about, you know, who's going to take the position. I also found out that during my interview, I had my sunglasses on the entire time.
Oh, gee.
And did not know. Wow. And these were Porsche Carrera driving glasses. Not that it was any kind of, you know, they were actually used,
yeah.
But they were the most comfortable glasses for me, and I actually kind of looked like a hitman. And Ron... somebody goes, well, have you posted yet? Yeah, we're going to give it to that Thornton guy. He seems like an assassin to where, you know, if any of our people give us trouble, you know, we could probably send him out.
Did they really say that?
Yeah, he really said that to me. So I get a phone call.
Who was Ron?
Ron Kidd. He was the director of product development. And
oh.
He was the guy that actually hired me. And I came in as the department clerk. I had a trailer that was back behind the Something Wicked This Way Comes set, which is now where the Frank G. Wells building is. And it was really cool to check in the office in the morning. You know, first off, driving onto the Disney lot. I started January 12, 1987. And February 12th was my birthday. And that was when the Disney store first opened on the lot.
Really?
And so there was
a
big celebration.
Great store because it was a very unique studio, and they didn't have Disney stores all over.
Right.
But it was also things only for employees.
Right.
I remember that.
Right off the commissary.
Yeah. When was that? That was 88?
87.
87.
And so on my birthday is when they actually opened it up, because I think my birthday happened to fall on a Monday that day. And I'm going, wow, it's my birthday, and I'm going to work at Disney. It doesn't really suck. And I pull into the driveway there off of Alameda, and there's three of the seven dwarfs out there waving me in. And they're going, they're having this for my birthday? Wow, this is a really cool place. No, it was a celebration for the Disney store.
Oh.
Yeah, it was just sort of a big party that they were having.
And that kind of stuff is so cool.
I know, it's just those little things. That I tell you, the first time I saw Mickey walking around the lot,
yeah.
It really does something to you. It's really something. And So I was hired as the department clerk, which meant I ran the master tape vault and I did all their running around. We now have couriers all over the place, but there were no couriers at this time. There was one computer in the department for 8 people, and it was a daisy wheel printer. It was the old Sperry computers. But I'm brought in as the clerk, and my first day of the orientation, you go through the whole thing, and I'm just so, you know, jazzed to be here. They took me out to the vault and showed me where the master tapes are, and they said, well, we haven't really had a clerk here for about 2 or 3 years, so everything's kind of in disarray. The clerk before you had pulled a bunch of tapes that he felt were useless, and he was going to throw them away, but he left before they were thrown away. So they're on the boxes here, so you can just go ahead and throw those out.
Oh, my.
And they're going, they left, and then sitting going, you know, because, you know, when you're there with the boss, you're going, oh, yeah, sure, yeah, not a problem.
Yeah.
Then when they left, I'm going, I don't know what these are. Who knows what these things could be?
Yeah.
So I just put them back on the shelves again. Good. Years later, it turns out that most of them were the 3 tracks for the Annette albums that I ended up using for the box set in 94. But it was just basically my job to run around and get product, and there was a book that I needed to check. I had a beeper, and I'd come up and see if there were any requests. If people needed product, I'd go out to the trailer and get it and bring it back to them. Very simple little things, and this was cool. And I go, my music background comes in handy here because of all the music that was done. My theater background comes in handy because of all the spoken word. And my art background comes in handy with all the books and layouts and things. I go, everything that I always wanted to do or wanted to be involved with was all combined here. And it's at Disney.
Yeah.
And one thing led to another. At that time, Alf had come out, and I was kind of an Alf fan. And I had an Alf stuffed doll sitting on my desk in my trailer. And Ron Kidd comes out and... he goes, just checking up to see how you're doing, and he sees the Alf doll, and he goes, wow, you know, they've been after us to do some product, some read-alongs on their character. Do you think this is going to be around a while? And I go, well, first off, I think he's absolutely hysterical. I think there's good messages in the stories that they're doing. I don't know how long it'll be around, maybe a couple of years. It's not a flash in the pan, but I don't think it's going to have this longevity. Because it is just a simple little sitcom, a good one, but...
And it wasn't a part of Disney. Then,
and right? It wasn't part of Disney at all. It was, we would license it. We'd done quite a bit of that. And he goes, well, why don't you write up an outline of what you think the first read-along would be? And I figured, well, it should be based on the pilot, on how he got here. And I had taped a lot of these things. So I went back and I sort of modified this thing to fit the book and tell a story in such a short period of time. And while I was coming up with that, I sort of came up with concepts for like 3 other stories. So I figured, well, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm pushing it, so I'll turn in this first outline and say, if you're interested, I have these other ideas. And so he had me write those up as well. And we ended up doing all 4 read-alongs. We got the license.
And the read-alongs were big in those days.
They were very big. That was our bread and butter. That's how we made money. What? More than any of the other albums.
More than soundtracks. Right?
More than soundtracks. That was what was making money. And
this was an extension of the ones where Tinkerbell rings her
little
bell.
And exactly. And as we still had the page turn chime, it's just that it wasn't Tinkerbell anymore. And those had developed earlier on, too. They were doing them in the late 60s, early 70s. And it was just basically single narrator, not character voices, and some spattering of sound effects and maybe some music from the film.
So in that one, for example, was Alf's voice in it?
Yeah, it was actually.
Oh, it was.
It was actually.
Oh, so that was.
We got the whole cast. We got the cast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And when Ted started doing the read-alongs, he sort of increased the production value, adding a little bit more specific sound effects. We were using character voices, separated narrator, and they were just becoming more elaborate and more production. But I was also the clerk, still doing the Alf stuff. And there were a couple of times where I had to take artwork all the way out to Alf Productions for them to view and everything. And Tom Patchett, who was one of the producers, was also did the Bob Newhart show. He's done quite a bit of television. And he was like 30 minutes late, and I was just sitting there waiting. And he goes, well, thank you for being so patient. I go, they're paying me to sit here. It's cool.
Yeah.
And he goes, I really like what you guys at Disney are doing. You guys really care about the character. And there's some really quality stuff. I particularly like the story about when Brian goes to camp and Alf sneaks into his duffel bag and goes to camp with him. And I go, well, I wrote that. He goes, oh, bravo. Bravo. But it was just really kind of cool to lead to that.
He was the creator, the producer?
He was the producer. And Paul Fusco.
The producer likes your story.
You're right. And Paul Fusco was the voice of Alf, and he's the creator. And he signed some of the paperwork for me, because I wasn't really involved in the studio at that point. I handed off the script, and Ted ended up producing those things. And again, it was all just sort of gravy. It was all really great. And then shortly after that, one of my first jobs here was to, they were beginning to work on our second and third CD releases. The first one being the Irwin Castle Fantasia digital recording.
Okay.
And that was done in 86, I believe. So it was before I was here. And CDs were brand new. That was the only one we had done.
Wow.
And they were going to be putting together the Disney Collections Volumes 1 and 2. And they had, Ron Kidd and Ted had gone to...
Well, there was a collection of just...
Disney
songs.
Right. Our first greatest hits on CD.
Checking.
And they got a lot of the analog transfers from Sound Transfer, and there was a lot of material. And I was assigned to go through and make a list of all the defects that I heard, all the artifacts and
quality
control.
Yeah.
And so I sat there with headphones. Ted had a quarter-inch tape machine that you actually had to stand up to edit because he didn't have any room in his office. So now when we have computers and I have sound baffling and all this stuff. Yeah. It was unbelievable. Razor blades.
Splicing
these things together.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I sat there and I listened and I made notes of all the things that I heard. And I came back with a big stack of notes. And I gave them to Ron. And he goes, "These are all the notes?" And I go, "Yeah." I mean, you know, I also said in there, you know, some are severe, some are not so severe, some I don't know whether you can do anything about. Because, well, there's this new technology called No Noise that this company called Sonic Solutions has developed that we will take all these recordings and your notes and send them up there, and they will attack, because I had written down what times I heard them on those reels, and they would denoise them. It was a process that needed to take a couple of days to do at the time. So they brought that, they took that stuff up there with my notes, and they denoised everything and cleaned everything up, and it was a very long, labor-intensive process at that time. And after the CDs were done, I was really blown away on how great Mary Poppins sounded. And
the
CD
of Mary Poppins?
Yeah, well, just those tracks.
Oh, the tracks.
Just, you know, I think Spoonful of Sugar, Jolly Holiday, and they just sounded great, because the older stuff was pretty old, and they sounded better than before, but, you know, there was still that limited dynamic range and all that kind of stuff. So I said, you know, the Poppins stuff just really sounded great. What are the chances of actually doing a Mary Poppins soundtrack remastered from the original sources? Because nobody's done a remastered soundtrack. The CDs were still coming out. They were just transferring their album masters onto CD. I guess nobody's gone back to the original elements and completely remixed it for CD. And he goes, "Well, I'd love to, but, you know, we just put Mary Poppins out on vinyl." I said, "Yeah, but the vinyl was just... was just not really good. It was from a bad master."
You actually said, you did tell me.
Yeah. And I go, "No, I mean, go back to the original sources." He goes, "Wow, you know, I'd love to. It's one of my favorites too, but this version isn't doing very well, and CDs are still kind of new. We would need something really special to get it pulled over with the administration." And while I was the clerk, I'd be going out and be playing tapes all the time. You know, pulling a tape off the thing and popping it on there. Because, again, I didn't know what they were, and I was just very, very careful, and I came across this one tape that said Mary Poppins pre-demo on it, and I played it, and it was just these two guys singing songs, and, you know...
Did you know who they were?
Now, I knew who the Sherman Brothers were,
yeah.
But I didn't know that that was them.
Them, right.
And I'm hearing this and going, "Wow, I hope that's not a finished product." It was demo piano, I mean, it was recorded okay.
Never intended for the public to be heard.
Never intended. Right. Never intended for the public to be
it
heard.
It was intended for Walt to be heard.
Right. So we can get the idea of the songs. And I'm going, "Wow." And some of the lyrics were different. And in Chim Chim Cheree, the chording was different. And some of the songs weren't there. There was no Jolly Holiday. Well, no, Jolly Holiday was there, but there was no Spoonful of Sugar. There were these other songs. Tiki Town and several of the others. And I played it, and I go, "Well, that's kind of interesting," and I just put it back on the shelf again. And when Ron said, "Well, we would need something really special," and I pull this tape up, and I go, "Do people know that this is here?" And Ron's jaw dropped. He goes, "No." And he calls the Sherman Brothers. They thought the tape was lost 25 years earlier.
Really?
Yeah, they thought it was gone.
Wow.
So that sort of got the whole ball rolling into getting the Mary Poppins done. And then Ron calls me and says, well, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. The good news is they're going to let us put Mary Poppins out on CD. And with your demo that you found, we're going to interview the Sherman Brothers and have them talk about these songs and put these things in. The bad news is we have to use the original album master. Now, you pulled the album master for me before, and I know you just put it away, but I need to play it for the boss, so could you pull it again? So I pull the master again, and I'm going, you know, it's just not right. You know, they should go back to the original elements.
Yeah.
I mean,
had that been done yet?
No. Nobody had ever done that, which is part of the reason why there was a little bit of trepidation.
Yeah.
We had only had 3 CDs at that point. You know, so, yeah. You know, Fantasia and the 2 Disney collections, and those were just came out. Huh. So, you know, they didn't know whether CDs were going to take off, and we were a very, very tiny company. There was only 30 people in all of the music company, and that included music publishing, mail order, and all that. I mean, there was only 30 people, so it was a very, very small company. So a risk like that is pretty big, particularly on an untried technology at that point. But I'm going, you know, if you only get one shot to do it, you got to do it right, because nobody's going to ever let you do something again, because say you put that Mary Poppins out there, and it does okay. If it doesn't do okay, it's going to kill any other title. If it does marginally, then nobody's going to be interested, and if you want to do it again and do it the right way, they'll never let you, because it's already been done. Yeah. So there's the master that all the vinyl records were made, and that's the master. Then a copy of that was made when this was finished, called a protection copy, that was kept at a separate location just in case anything happened to the one, there'd always be this other one to go to. And that it was a generation down. So I took the master, put it in the protection copy box, took the protection copy, put it in the master box, and I don't know how it happened, but the tape got a little too close to a magnet. And I took it back, because I figured, you know, if I have to follow my sword, I follow my sword. You know, it's been a cool little run here, and, you know, I was only 29, so... So I take it back, and this jerry-rigged protection copy, give it to Ron. Ron plays it for the bosses, and it's just... Now, keep in mind, the master is in still perfect condition. I did not touch the master. This is a copy of the master. That shouldn't be done either, what I did. I acknowledge that. And he calls me up, and he says, you can take the tape back now. Wow, I don't remember it sounding that badly before. And I go, yeah. And, wow, I could have sworn that there was leader in between the tracks on the other. But good news is, they were so disappointed with the sound quality of this, we've already committed to doing it, that they're going to let me go back to the original elements and remix it. They go, oh, that's really good. He goes, yeah, I'm watching you. It was all in good fun, because we ended up getting what we wanted from the beginning. And I still, to this day, have never really told him exactly what it is. He knows I did something. But I'm sure he knows now that I also would never destroy a master either.
Yeah.
But that was what sort of kickstarted the whole thing. Unfortunately, CDs were new. Ron wanted to include the underscore and all that kind of stuff too, but we just couldn't. And it was our first remaster. It was, as far as we know, the first remastered soundtrack ever. Right. Digital remaster. It was all cleaned up. Sean Murphy remixed it. And while Ron was in the studio working on it, I get this phone call saying that he wanted me to drop off something out at the CBS Television City, which is where they were mixing.
Oh.
And I'm going, wow. He asked me to put that back in the... Well, you know, I don't care. I'm going to drive out there. All it was an excuse for him to get me out there. Because sitting in the studio was Irwin Costell and Bob Sherman.
Oh, man.
And I was introduced as the guy who found the long-lost Mary Poppins demo tape.
Really?
And that's when I met Bob for the first time. It was shortly after that I met Dick.
And Irwin, who was
and Irwin, who
did
was
the whole score, oh, as well as the sound, many things with Sound of Music.
Oh, Sound of Music, West Side Story. I mean, it just goes on and on. He did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with the Sherman Brothers later on.
And with that album, had there been any other soundtrack that had an interview? Or was there even CDs with interviews? I mean, that was just so
No, I think it was something new. I think it was really something new.
And then you included a couple demos on that album, which were the ones you were talking about.
Yeah, from that demo tape. That's pretty much how we got the okay to do the soundtrack, was because they wanted to do this interview. They wanted to have that extra thing to say. It was beyond just the music. It was 1990 when I was asked if there was something else, other soundtrack that we should do, and I said The Jungle Book. And it turns out The Jungle Book was being re-released. And that one I was given complete. I produced that as the clerk. I was still the clerk.
Wow.
Still got paid hourly wage.
And I have that one, too.
Tons of overtime. And because the interview would work so well, and one of the demos, The Land of Sand, meant for Mary Poppins, became Trust in Me in The Jungle Book, were able to include that, and, you know, just sort of spruce that up a little bit. Plus, I found songs that the Sherman Brothers had written for more Jungle Book, a storyteller album sequel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we put those on there, and that really started my really close relationship with the Sherman Brothers. When I did the Jungle Book soundtrack, I put a lot of the instrumental lead-ins back into the songs, because the original vinyl album was just songs. It was really cumbersome, but I was working with Bruce Botnick, who was Tootie Camarada's protege, and Tootie was the original A&R director.
Is he still alive?
Tootie passed away 2 years ago, which is unfortunate.
You introduced me to him.
Yeah.
And we brought in the camera.
Yep, and I still have that picture.
Yeah.
For the Annette sessions.
Yeah.
And Tootie was something else. He's the reason why Walt Disney Records exists. I know it was Jimmy Johnson that started the company, and it was Roy Disney's idea to do the company, but the reason why the company still exists, and why Annette had a career, and why the Beatles overtracked and dubbed some of their voices, was because of techniques that Tootie did for Annette.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Annette never really had a strong voice, but she could mimic herself well, and this is what Tootie said. That they would double track her voice. She would sing it once, then play back, and sing to herself singing it again. And that created the unique Annette sound,
which was unique
at the time. And then Lennon heard that and incorporated that into the Beatles songs later on.
Her singing twice.
Right. and not even necessarily singing harmony to herself. Sometimes she would break into a harmony in a chorus, but it was basically singing in unison. But Tootie was really something. And it was 94. I wanted to do the Annette box set.
Were you a producer yet?
I had gotten my producership right after The Jungle Book, so I was producer at that point. Right after Jungle Book, the company split. Let's see, when I started, it was Disneyland Vista Records, which is what it was originally. And then in about 1989 is when we changed our name to Walt Disney Records.
Oh.
Then in 1990, new management came in and decided it would be a good idea to split the company into two. Hmm. The music division would be Walt Disney Records, the spoken word division would be called Disney Audio Entertainment. I never thought that was a really good idea. It only lasted a year, but that's what happened. And Michael Leon came in. He started as a temp and ended up starting to produce some things. And one of his first assignments was the Pinocchio soundtrack. And I was afraid of going back to the older stuff because I didn't think the technology was ready to denoise it. And again, you only get one shot at these things. And I don't want to waste it on something that I can wait a few years. It turns out that they were gutting the prop warehouse, which is where they were storing these reels as well, along with our master tapes, getting ready to build the animation building. And they came across these reels that were unmarked, and people put them up, and it turned out to be some of the original music sessions for Pinocchio. Not all of them, not all the separated elements. Because one of the things we discovered is that most of these older films, the separated elements were destroyed in the 50s, because a lot of them were on nitrate, that had this wonderful ability to spontaneously combust for no reason. It was very difficult, truly.
Wow.
And that's why they developed safety film, and why it's called safety film, because it doesn't explode. And in the 50s is when this conversion started taking over and getting rid of all the nitrate. They made a very bad decision back then. They got rid of everything except the composite, which is the music in a effects and dialogue mixed, and the music and effects tracks, so they can dub other languages on it. But all the separated elements, all the original orchestra recordings, all the separated vocal recordings, they figured, well, we're never going to go back and remix the film again. So they ended up destroying them. Wow. But they didn't destroy everything. Sometimes reels were pulled aside to make copies of, because Walt was going to use it on a television show, so they might have been in process at the moment they were doing the big purge, so some of those reels were missing. And as good as the library guys are about keeping track of that stuff at the time, things get misplaced when you have such a plethora of material. You know, things get misplaced. And thankfully so, some things got lost. And Pinocchio was saved because it wasn't marked. The only vocal tracks they were able to find that were separated that they can use with this music, these isolated music tracks, were the vocal tracks for When You Wish Upon a Star. So, if you're going to find material, that was the good song to find it on.
Yeah.
So, Michael put that together, and at the same time, the guys were restoring the film. So, Michael gets a call from the guys that were restoring the film at the time. And evidently, Katzenberg heard the Pinocchio soundtrack and goes, why does this CD sound better than our movie?
Really?
Well, I can tell you why, and it's nothing really spectacular outside of the fact that we can use elements that the film people can't. We don't need the dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, we could use these music-only tracks, whereas they can't.
Yeah.
Because they could if they had the dialogue tracks, but they didn't have access to the dialogue tracks. So, but that put the guys that were doing the film in a bad light, and unjustly. And the next film was going to be Pinocchio, so they wanted to work. Well, the next film was going to be Snow White, so they wanted to work with us on Snow White. And at that time, the company had been brought back together. Walt Disney Records and Disney Entertainment was now back as Walt Disney Records again. And I was over at Michael's office, and we get this phone call from a guy named Scott McQueen, who was over in Library Restoration at the time, going, what you guys did on the Pinocchio soundtrack was incredible. If there's anything help you need. And I said, well, Michael's just given me the Snow White soundtrack to work on, and I can't find anything. I went through everything over in Sound Transfer, music and effects mixes, you know, there's none of these stuff, nothing, nothing. He goes, well, actually, I have what's left of the nitrates that I'm supposed to ship out to the Library of Congress next week, but we don't have money to make copies of it.
Really?
Yeah. And I go, we'll make copies of it, and I'll give you a copy of the copies.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm thinking, if it goes to the Library of Congress, I'm just envisioning the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, I know it's completely invalid. I know these guys are very, very good about keeping track of these things, but, you know, oh my God. I mean, it's difficult enough to get this stuff when it's on our property, let alone when it's cataloged with somebody else. No matter how great they are about taking care of it, it's going to be a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
So we transferred the stuff. The stuff sounded really good. Michael started getting busy. I ended up editing this thing. And what I did was I found about 8 different sources. And there wasn't a lot of sound effects, but there were some. And we had the clean nitrates, which actually were the best sounding elements. So I used that as the foundation, and whatever I didn't have of that, I would go to these other sources. So I edited this thing together, piece by piece. There's over 1,000 edits in it.
Oh my.
And if you listen on headphones, you can hear the noise floor going.
Really?
Still? I mean, yeah, to this day, yeah.
Wow.
Because the texture of the transfers.
Yeah.
We discovered at that point that it wasn't the recording that was bad in those days, it was the reproduction. Recordings, if you can go back to the original recordings, I mean, some of them, you know, you still have the limitations with the microphones, sound really, really good. It's just that when they played it back to record onto another tape, it's that playback that was really bad. It really started cutting in the high end and cutting in that depth that you would get even in a mono recording. So that was the main issue there. But I edited these things. It took me about 6 months. And as I said, there's over 1,000 edits and 7 different sources used to recreate that one soundtrack. And I figured if we can do that with Snow White, the oldest of the animated features, and we can save it, then there isn't going to be a problem with any of the other stuff. No matter how bad, it can't be as bad as that.
Right.
And as they were close, but none of them have ever been that bad. And there was actually some pieces like the old crones race up the mountain before she gets killed. That doesn't exist anymore without sound effects. And that's, the music's all drowned out because it's thunder and lightning.
Yeah.
You know, there was just no way to really save that. It's, I mean, obviously it's there in the movie.
Yeah.
But the music itself
is
gone. And I'm very much a person that the soundtrack is a different listening experience. And it is a listening experience. That's the only way I could relive the movies when I was a kid, was to put these things in there. That's why all the soundtracks that I do, all the music's in chronological order. So you can put it in your player and close your eyes and just imagine the movie in your head. I try not to put any sound effects in. Sometimes sound effects work, like when I did Bambi. The hunter's gunshot that kills Bambi's mother.
Yeah.
That's an important part of the music. It has to be there. So it's just that little delicate balance. But after Snow White, that's when everything's really started kicking in. And then we did the Annette box set, and then there was the talk of doing the classic soundtrack series, and I was going to do Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, and Bambi. And I actually had those done, and then the project was pulled. And about a year or two years later, another project had fallen out, one of the more contemporary projects, and they really needed something, you know, to make budget and all that. And I said, well, I have these three soundtracks. They're already done. We've already spent the money to restore them and clean them up. Let's put them out there. And that's what started the resurgence with the classic soundtracks.
We hope you've enjoyed this Mouse Clubhouse conversation. Thank you for joining us.